If you've ever heard your sugar's a little high, we'll just watch it, this episode is for you. Pre-diabetes is not something to watch. It's your early warning, and it's also your best chance to turn things around before it becomes type 2 diabetes. And for the people already living with type 2, yes, remission is possible for many patients. And yes, you can protect your eyes, kidneys, nerves, and heart. We're talking about food you'll actually eat, realistic daily changes, and why needing medication is not a personal failure. This is not about shame. This is about taking control. Let's get into it.
Today's episode of Vital Voices is brought to you by Oak Tree Medical Center and Wellspring Lifestyle Group.
Vital Voices.
Welcome to Vital Voices, the podcast where we amplify the stories, insights, and expertise of the people shaping the future of our communities, our conversations, and our country. I'm your host, Alexis Burrows. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're talking about blood sugar, pre-diabetes, and type 2 diabetes, and whether they can actually be reversed or pushed into remission. Our guest is endocrinologist Dr. Carmen Cartwright, who is also clinical director of specialty clinic at Oak Tree Medical Center. She treats patients every day who are trying to stop pre-diabetes from becoming diabetes, and people already living with type 2 who want to get their numbers down and protect their eyes, kidneys, nerves, and heart. We're going to cover what those diagnoses really mean, what remission actually is, the role of food, movement, sleep, stress, and medication, and the first two changes you should make if your doctor just said your sugar is high. Quick note, this conversation is for education, not individual medical advice. Please talk to your own provider. So let's get started. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Cartwright.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to sit and chat with you.
Awesome. So we are in November, which is recognized both nationally and internationally as Diabetes Awareness Month. And so we are happy to have you on the show to talk about diabetes from a slightly different angle than people normally do. We want to talk about the possibility of reversing pre-diabetes and trying to move, if you have type 2 diabetes, into remission. A lot of people, especially in recent years with the advancement of lifestyle medicine and things like that, you start to hear a lot of people talking about, you can reverse your diabetes. From a medical point of view, is that true? What does reversal or remission actually mean?
Excellent. So, I'm excited for us to have this chat in Diabetes Awareness Month because, unfortunately, a lot of our Bahamian public is affected by diabetes. Mm-hmm. I'm confident that, unfortunately, a lot of our Bahamian public is also affected by pre-diabetes and they just don't know. So, if you look at U.S. data, mind you, it's some pretty old data. It's a little bit over 10 years old. Even at that time, for patients between the ages of like 20 and 50, the incidence of pre-diabetes was almost 40%. Mm. As we age, the incidence, unfortunately, goes up. And even in my practice, patients that sometimes will get sent to me, even for other issues, not actually for diabetes, as I review their history, as I review their labs, I'm like, by chance, did you guys discuss the fact that you're actually a pre-diabetic? And a lot of times patients aren't necessarily informed or aware. Mm. So I think it's a very appropriate topic for us to really try and help the community. So you were asking in terms of, is there a possibility for reversal or remission mm-hmm. in patients that have type 2 or pre-diabetes?
Yes.
And yes, there definitely is. I would say there will be some patients that will be more likely to achieve that. Mm-hmm. There can be instances where, depending on your family history, the way your body appears, your overall health status, whether it might be harder for you compared another person, mm-hmm. But it is definitely possible. But I would say, whenever I talk to patients about diabetes, the same as when I talk about pre-diabetes, we talk about numbers and we talk about goals, it's because this translates to quality and quantity of life, the mm-hmm. same way as you did in the intro mentioning that we're trying to avoid complications.
Yes.
So our goal, truthfully, for most of my patients, I'm always trying to achieve as much as you can from a lifestyle to minimize medication exposure. Why not, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when I meet patients, because unfortunately some of the patients will meet me when they're already on 3-4 medications, insulin, and they feel frustrated, and they're trying to find out in the first visit, doc, can this be reversed? And I have to be honest with them in that I will say, I give them an honest answer based over their overall clinical picture, how likely will it be? But sometimes I have to tell them only time will tell me, in that we have to see how things are progressing and be, constantly doing a pulse check. It can't just be, my A1C at 3 months. For some patients, it could be. And for pre-diabetics, we'll talk about hemoglobin A1C and other parameters of how we diagnose it. But then it shouldn't necessarily be just a yearly check, especially if you have a strong family history. So you know what? I'm not going to wait for the year. But yes, reversal. And I more so like the word remission. the reason I like remission better is because that means that we still have to keep a tab on it. You still have to keep a check on it to ensure that it doesn't recur. Unless there's a reason, you know, medication exposure that was really driving it, and now that exposure has been removed. Because when we talk about insulin resistance, there are certain medications that push that and can put you at increased risk for diabetes or pre-diabetes. And then let's say if that entity is removed, then your risk goes back down.
Right. Fair enough. I mean, I think, I imagine one of the important parts of that is, you know, patient adherence to whatever is prescribed, whether it's lifestyle, whether it's medication. That's always a big part of that conversation in terms of what is possible. A lot of that is hinging on, you know, are you doing what you should be doing when you're getting the advice or the directives from your physician and you're going back out into your everyday life? I imagine that's a big part of it.
Most definitely.
So for listeners who may be unfamiliar, I know we might have covered this, I think, when we had you on last year and we were talking about diabetes, but we always appreciate there might be new listeners to the show. So what is the difference between pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes in terms of, you know, the numbers, and then also like just how your body works and what's happening on the inside?
Excellent. Okay. So I think the way I perceive pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, now this doesn't really account for type 1. And, you know, we've had a conversation about that in the previous cast, and we can always talk about that at length. But this is more so talking about patients pre-diabetic and type 2 diabetics. Right. I see it as a spectrum in that type 2 diabetes is driven by insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. Insulin, to remind everyone, is a hormone, a chemical messenger made by your pancreas, an organ in the body that helps to control your sugar levels. In patients who are pre-diabetic or they convert over into full-blown type 2 diabetes, your insulin is no longer working as well as it should. It's called insulin resistance, reduced sensitivity. So for patients with pre-diabetes, most patients won't have any symptoms at all. It's going to be something that your doctor mentions to you on your blood work. Or I've even had people mention it to me, oh, you know, my mom has diabetes. She was checking her sugar. I was hanging around. I wanted to check my sugar and I saw that it wasn't, or my mom said I should get checked because I'm not sure if it's normal or not. And most patients, again, with pre-diabetes will not have symptoms. Hemoglobin A1C, that's your 3-month sugar average, sometimes you'll hear doctors refer to it as the A1C, can be used as a way to diagnose pre-diabetes. That would be a level 5.7 up to 6.4. A normal level completely is around 5, 5.5. Sometimes people can have slightly lower levels. Whereas when we then transition over into full-blown diabetes, that's an A1C of 6.5 or higher. If we then use fasting sugars, so you check your finger prick or you have a blood draw done when you do your annual and you fast for a couple hours before, fasting sugars above 100, less than 126 are pre-diabetes, 126 or higher is diabetes. When patients are pre-diabetic, another term you might hear is impaired fasting glucose. Again, your fasting sugar is above normal but not yet diabetic. Or you can have impaired glucose tolerance where people do a 2-hour glucose tolerance test. They have you drink some really sugary liquid. All of the ladies that are listening who've ever gone through pregnancy unfortunately knows what it tastes like because we all get screened for gestational diabetes. 2 hours afterwards, if your sugar is above 140 but less than 200, that would be pre-diabetes. Whereas if it's above 200, that's diabetes. So different ways that we as physicians can look at your risk and help you to understand, some patients will hear the word borderline. Oh, I got to keep an eye on my sugar. But no, I'm not yet a diabetic. Those are the numbers that you could look at.
Okay.
Whereas it's not until type 2 diabetes that you typically will start to have the symptoms of high sugars.
Right. I know you mentioned earlier on that, you know, we have a high rate of diabetes and pre-diabetes here in the country. Who is most at risk of developing, you know, pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes? And then are there risks that we are in control of that we can change? And some that we can't, perhaps.
For sure. So I would say people who are at risk, unfortunately, genetically, right? If you look at your mom, your dad, if you've had siblings that have already gone through it, a grandmother, that is something that you unfortunately cannot change, right? We don't get to pick the family that we have. Right. Other things, mostly otherwise, beg your pardon, things you can modify, that would be lifestyle. So people are going to be at risk, unfortunately, obese, overweight patients. Patients who live a sedentary lifestyle, so you're not doing any exercise outside of what you might do for just daily functioning, daily living. Patients who have issues with you know, chronic stress. There is some data suggests that stress itself can also increase insulin resistance. Definitely patients who are on chronic medications that unfortunately can increase insulin resistance. So that's steroids. Like, let's say if someone's going through a severe autoimmune disease, they see rheumatology, or they have a recurrent issues with joint pains and they're put on steroids, that can increase insulin resistance. Patients who are on HIV therapy, some of them can increase insulin resistance. People who go through transplants. And thankfully, I've seen quite a few patients here at home who've been graciously granted transplants. Long-term anti-rejection medicines that help you to hold onto your transplant can also increase insulin resistance. So some of those things might be able to be removed, but not necessarily all of them. So I would say the big modifiable part of pre-diabetic or patient with pre-diabetes, bigger part of our type 2 diabetes, is going to be lifestyle. Exercise and diet.
Fair enough. So when we talk about the word, you know, reversal or remission, right? Take it to the labs, because you mentioned A1C, right? But what are you looking for as a physician that has to change in the labs to say, okay, we can now say that your pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes is either in remission or has been reversed?
Understood. So I would say, if I have a patient with pre-diabetes, and let's say the first time I meet them, their A1C, that 3-month sugar average, is at the higher end. They're like 6.3, 6.4. Because remember, 6.5 or higher is diabetes. So they're almost there. They're almost on the cliff. And we talk about their diet, and they mentioned to me, you know, a lot of sugar, sweetened beverages. They mentioned, you know, I eat Kentucky almost every day, whatever it might be. And sometimes it doesn't have to be to that extreme either. It can actually be they eat a lot of carbs that can be nutritious and healthy, right? Like plants and you know, sweet potato, cassava, breadfruit, all of these things that are naturally grown for us in our community have a lot of starch. So anyway, let's say that they have that in their diet and we make these changes. And then I see them in a month, they're doing some finger sticks. Although for pre-diabetics, I usually don't belabor them with finger sticks. I reserve that for when they actually become a diabetic. Although there are new devices, the Dexcom Stelo, which is the first, beg your pardon, FDA approved over-the-counter continuous glucose monitor that pre-diabetics could wear. Type 2 diabetics only on oral medications could wear if they wanted for sugar monitoring. But if I see them back and I notice that their fasting sugar is where I want it to be, I see their A1C has come down to 5.2, 5.3, you're in remission. And again, I like remission better than reversal because they need to keep a tab on it to make sure it doesn't recur and come back. For type 2s, then it would be usually that those patients are on medication. Some of them don't even need medication. I've had patients who come to me with an A1C of 10% and it's all diet. And we talk about diet. They're drinking sodas 3-4 times a day. You know, they have large servings of carbs. It's really the sugar sweetened beverages, I think, is like the crux for a lot of people. And then portion sizes in our community, which I know we talked about that with our last talk. Mrs. Cambridge, shout out to her for always giving us wealth of information. The carb portions that we have as a typical Bahamian diet, it should not be real life.
It's heavy.
It should not be real life. But let's say if I see that they're able to cut down on their medications, each time I see them, sugar levels are looking good. Let's say if we've repeated an A1C, because sometimes I'll see people in between and just let them wear a device for sugar monitoring or do the finger sticks. And I try to take the medications away. And I always say, yes, we're doing this, but it isn't that we're not still doing our checks and balances to make sure you're still controlled.
Right.
Because unfortunately, I have met patients before who will say, you know, doc, I want to do this naturally. I am all for the consideration for lifestyle changes, but, you know, for some patients who are going to tell me I'm going to have soursop leaf tea but never check my sugar, you're not answering the question to make sure that you're okay.
Right, because you have to test it. You have to know that
Correct.
It's actually changing.
Yes,
right.
Yes, especially if you're making big changes. So for type 2s, to consider them in remission, I would want to see decreasing medication requirements, sugar's still in the range we're aiming for, and then if I'm able to take more and more away, and then the A1C, even for diabetics, if it's in a pre-diabetic range, mm-hmm. I would consider that remission.
Mm.
It doesn't have to go completely normal.
Right.
But because again, you're still coming from a higher state to a lower spectrum, right? So that's what I would consider remission for them.
Mm. Okay, understood. Would you say that there's like a window where, you know, it's easier on one end versus more, like, so for example, Would it be easier for someone who is, you know, just recently diagnosed with prediabetes to go through the process of getting into remission than somebody who may have had diabetes for 5, 7, 10 years?
I would say physiologically, you would anticipate yes. For patients who have gone only just come to know, which doesn't mean they've only just had it, right?
That is also true.
That part we have to think about. But right. Let's say in best case scenario, they just found out and it really just happened versus someone who has known about it for years. You would anticipate the person who only just found about it hasn't had as much strain on their pancreas, because when you're having insulin resistance, again, your pancreas is having to push out way more insulin than it really should to achieve the same state of normal sugar. So the anticipation would be that someone who's had it for longer, that it would be harder, let's say. But I also think that, you know, our bodies are not in a vacuum. There's so many variables. So again, if still that person who's had prediabetes for 10 years has never listened to Cambridge and never changed their diet,
right,
has never enrolled in programs. I know we were talking about, you guys are doing a community program at your church to get people active, and they're not doing something like that. How do you expect something to change if you haven't made the effort? You see what I mean? So I still think my goal is everyone has the opportunity, and then we just see what happens. But yes, the longer you have it, the more strain on your pancreas. But theoretically, at some point, your pancreas can get very tired and just said, I'm done. Stop asking me for more.
Yeah, and that's the issue. That's the real issue there. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, speaking of, we started calling her our resident nutritionist, Mrs. Cambridge. You know, we do want to talk a little bit about food and, you know, the metabolic healing process. So, you know, people hear so many rules when they start to hear about how they can make adjustments to fight, you know, diabetes, prediabetes, and try to move into a space of remission. What does an ideal plate look like for someone who's trying to reverse prediabetes? Let's start there.
Okay. Then I would say an ideal plate, we really need to include more non-starchy vegetables in our diet. We need more fiber in our diet. Getting rid of sugar sweetened beverages. And sometimes, again, people will have a misconception, oh, she's only talking about sodas. No. I'm talking about juices. I'm talking about lemonades, sweet teas. You know, I had a patient just today actually talked about cranberry juice and was, you know, it's a misconception, full of antioxidants and vitamins. It's got to be great. Yes, it has those benefits. But have you ever eaten a raw cranberry? Next time, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up, Christmas is coming up. My husband makes really good cranberry sauce. Shout out to him. When you taste a raw cranberry, it is what I imagine eating Joy tastes like. It is very tart. It is not pleasant. So to make cranberry juice or cranberry sauce sweet, they add a lot of sugar. So either way, I think the issue is that we have also too much processed foods. So you need to add more non-starchy vegetables. That needs to be, for a pre-diabetic, I would propose like a third of your plate non-starchy vegetables, a third of your plate lean proteins, less processed foods. So less hot dogs and bologna and things of that nature, right? And then a third of your plate for complex carbohydrates. So more so brown rice instead of white rice, wheat or brown bread and whole grain bread instead of white bread. And it's not to say that these things don't still have carbs. They still have carbs, they still have calories, but it's the way your body processes them that allows for improved sugar control. And I would say that's the biggest place, or the portion sizes of what a plate could look like for a pre-diabetic.
Right. Because the complex carbs, I'm trying to see if I remember this right, it takes longer for the sugar to release, right? And that's where the benefit comes versus something that's a simple carb or a simple starch.
Exactly. So a simple refined sugar would be like white bread, white rice, pastries, guava duff, you know, all those good things.
That spike your sugar.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. They'll send it rising very quickly.
You know, how much does that plate change, or does it change at all if someone already has type 2 diabetes?
It would change slightly in that the premise is still the same, in that more non-starchy vegetables, get rid of the sugar sweetened beverages, reduce the processed foods, but then it would be half of your plate non-starchy vegetables, a quarter of your plate the lean protein, and then a quarter of your plate the carbs. But again, I would say the utility of someone like Mrs. Cambridge is to help you understand that that is a place to start. Yeah. In that, if your goal isn't just diabetes control, let's say your goal is also, I have high blood pressure, Your goal is, I have uncontrolled cholesterol. Your issues are, you have chronic kidney disease. You know, that plate is going to change in that the options that you have. And then if you're trying for weight loss. So for instance, what I need to eat versus what you need to eat to achieve weight loss is different because your caloric requirements are different based off of where you're starting.
Right.
So I'd say that's a good place to start, but it does not replace a nutritionist.
I don't think anything really replaces a good nutritionist.
For sure.
Mrs. Cambridge is a great nutritionist. We've had her on the show a number of times. Always great information. Always very helpful. I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 242-8164-OPP, 4667, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus, where your health comes first.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring, compassionate, complete.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI at Top of the Hill, Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram Movement continues. Call us today at 242-32-21145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring. Compassionate. Complete.
Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation. So going a little bit further in this, we obviously talked about carbs a little bit. And, you know, for us, there's so many things that are a common part of our diet that sit in that, just, you know, whether it's rice, peas and rice, macaroni, Johnny cake, conch fritters. You know, you have the auntie or the grammy in the family who's make the fruit punch juice, you know, all these different things.
My mother-in-law, yes.
Right, you know, grammy with the chocolate cake. You know, how do we adjust portions or preparation without feeling like, because I think it's that feeling of I can't eat food anymore, right? Mm-hmm. I think sometimes that is the thought that people have, is that, well, you're taking away all of the things that I like.
Right.
So, you know, how do we adjust without kind of causing that feeling?
Understood. I would say also, unfortunately, some patients will have that mindset. So for instance, I'll have patients tell me that when I start to tell them, because this is a conversation I usually have, I will say, you know, we are all human. We have to find something that is going to be a realistic lifestyle change for you. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to hear the word diet, because this is something you want to find sustainable. Because I'm sure I myself could decide to eat only salad and protein 3 meals a day for a week. Do I want to do that for my entire life? No. Does anybody want that? Not really, unless you really like salad, which some people do. So I think a big part of it is having your mindset ready. So some patients will tell me, doc, don't tell me that I could have a little bit of peas and rice, because I'll start to have that conversation with them. I'll start to say, okay, this is what the plate needs to start out as. Half non-starchy vegetables, 1/4 for your starch, 1/4 for your protein, and then I hone in on the starch. And I like to point out that corn is a starch, rice, potatoes, breadfruit, cassava, bread, I said breadfruit already, pumpkin, plantain, all the fruits, all of that is starch. So we have to consider, again, the portion size is the biggest thing. But I try to tell patients, don't see it as an end-all be-all. So for instance, let's say it's someone's birthday and there's going to be birthday cake. Am I telling you to never eat birthday cake again? No, I don't think so. At least that's not the way I would approach it.
Right.
But some patients will tell me, doc, don't tell me that because I don't think I can control myself.
Just then I'm going to have two slices of cake
exactly.
and a pint of ice cream.
Right. So that's the other way I'll explain to them. I say, you know, when I talk about this quarter of the plate, I'm not telling you can pile high that quarter of the plate. It's still a quarter of the plate. So let's say, again, it's a get-together and someone's made rice and macaroni, potato salad, a 3S bakery bun, and there's also going to be cake. Mm-hmm. Then I tell them, if you are deciding that you want a small piece of that cake, realistic piece of that cake, then you have to take something away from the plate from the meal just before it. You have to take away some of the rice. You have to take away some of the macaroni. Would I say have processed, you know, vanilla cake every day? Of course not, because that's also not really healthy for you. There are also ways that you can try to, you know, incorporate different ways to make these baked goods.
Right.
I myself had a slice of monk fruit cheesecake from Acropolis. This was months ago. It wasn't bad. I have to be honest. It wasn't bad. I love their baked goods. And I did a test and I did a finger prick. Just, I wanted to see, and it didn't spike my sugar. So monk fruit, for instance, is a natural sweetener from Asia, like from that part of the world, that a lot of people are trying. So there are different ways you can maybe try to change how you're baking and making different things at home.
Yeah, I think that's helpful too. When you start to talk about, like, you know, for some people, it's like, okay, for me, for example, right? My mom would always tell the story, like, I would come in the room at 7 a.m. in the morning, mommy, I want tea, right? And so now I have a daughter who will come out in the morning, mommy, daddy, I want tea, right? First thing in the morning. And, you know, through our journey as a family, so like initially we switched from using sugar to using honey, right? But then we also went a step further. We discovered like date sugar and date syrup, right? And so you could buy the date syrup out of the store, which is a pretty penny, but you could also buy just the dates out of the store, and you could actually blend it down with water, and you can make it yourself, and you get a much more bang for your buck that way. But it's like we've shifted to using that as a sweetener in most instances for tea, right? And so it's like you have these natural options for getting sweeteners in a way that is not necessarily like as bad as you would have, you know, white sugar, even brown sugar. And so you just have to kind of think through. And like you said, it's not so much about, you know, sit down and eat water wafer and wind pie, right? But it's more like, let's figure out a way to manage what you're eating so that you think eating with that thought process in mind of how am I keeping my body healthy and under control. Okay. You know, I think you touched on this a little bit, but I think there's a specific thing where, you know, because we, I think sometimes the pendulum swings, you know, too far in one direction or the other, right? And so for some people, it's like, well, I don't want you telling me that I can't eat anything. But then some people go the opposite direction and be like, okay, so carbs are evil in every instance, right? Clear up how that works, right? Because, you know, there's all kind of options out there. People talk about, you know, you hear all of these different extreme diets and then things that may be less extreme. You hear things like keto, Mediterranean, all of these different things. Mm-hmm. You know, can you clear up the concept of that dieting space versus just like sustainable glucose control?
Okay. So I think if you look at the majority of the data, Mediterranean diet is actually one of the best that we should try to mimic from a lifestyle standpoint in general. For sugar, blood pressure, cholesterol control. And Mediterranean food is awesome. Acropolis gets my money too much. But shout out also to Kebab House in Palmdale. Mm-hmm. So they're not the only ones. So I think that one has a lot of data. Keto diet. And again, you hear diet. Mediterranean diet. That would be the only time I like the word diet. With keto, the problem I have with keto is it's very restrictive. It's like Atkins amplified in that you're doing protein and veggies, pretty much no starch, but it's at the sacrifice of your cholesterol. Because it's almost like, hey, you want to make this piece of meat and a whole stick of butter, go right ahead, but then your cholesterol is going to suffer. So unfortunately, and fortunately, for patients who have diabetes, it's not just sugar control. Yes, I like to look at sugar numbers, quality and quantity of life. I keep telling people that. But then if your blood pressure or your cholesterol is not controlled, your risk for heart attack or stroke has not improved enough for me to feel confident that I've done the best by you. So you have to think about all of those components. And again, I think that's why a lot of times it could be overwhelming for people. So keto, not the biggest fan. I think if someone were to consider to do keto for a season, and again, in that sense, you're thinking about it as a diet, especially someone who wants to lose weight. Mm-hmm. It is not safe for people with severely uncontrolled cholesterol. I would not recommend it for someone who's already had a heart attack or a stroke. And if they were aiming for weight loss, then you could consider it for a season. I still don't think it's the healthiest option. Intermittent fasting has surprisingly been shown to improve insulin resistance. So for some patients who can really get away with intermittent fasting, and for anyone who's listening who doesn't really know what it is, you can do it two different ways. Sometimes it's a particular eating window per day. So for instance, you give yourself, between the hours of, 11 a.m. and 7 p.m., this is what I'm gonna eat. The other hours of the day, I can only have liquids and mainly gonna be non-sugary beverages like water, right? Or I've had some patients who will actually, eat a balanced diet for 3 days and then skip a whole day. I can't do that, that's not me. But some people will do that. Again, maintaining hydration is key. Anybody that's gonna try that, you have to be safe. Don't hurt your kidneys in the meantime. But again, I think the overall goal has to be a lifestyle change, something that you could see as a long-term change. And it takes time. It also takes it takes willpower. And it also takes giving yourself grace in that when things don't consistently line up every single time, realize that you are human. For the listeners out there who don't really see me other than a picture, I'm an obese person. I've been dealing with it my life, right? In that there will be times that I can do really well because I know what to do. I tell people what to do all the time. But we also have to find a way to make it work for ourselves. Right. So I say that to say there will be ebbs and flows in consistency. Mm-hmm. And again, give yourself grace. Mm-hmm. But also do the best that you can by your body.
Yeah, because I think sometimes what happens is if you don't give yourself grace and you end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right?
Correct.
Because then it's like, I can't do this consistently every day for weeks and months at a time, so just forget it.
Yep.
And I think that's where the concept of giving grace comes in, right? If you have an off day, if you have an off week,
right,
don't just say, well, I give up entirely.
Right.
Just recognize what it is. It was an off day. It was an off week. Let me get back on track.
I would say another thing just to bounce off of that for a second, and I'm sorry that it's kind of a tangential thought, but a lot of patients who are dealing with type 2 diabetes, not so much our pre-diabetics, but with type 2 diabetes, it is a chronic illness. Patients can get overwhelmed. They could say, I'm not really interested in seeing Dr. Garrett every 3 months. I don't want to see doctors right now. And I just want listeners to be aware that depression can happen in these states. Don't be afraid to reach out. If you have, someone in your church you feel comfortable to talk to, we have psychiatrists and psychologists in the community that can also help you, because patients can get in those states where they just get overwhelmed and say, why me? Why this? Why does it have to be this way? And, mm-hmm. They can help you to cope as you find a new way that creates a new normal for you.
Yeah. No, I think that's very helpful. I know for us, you mentioned that we were talking off air a little bit before we started. The group that my wife is leading in our church now, the Body and Soul group, a big part of that is community. Because that is a big part of it. Your social connections are important when it comes to going through any sort of challenge, whether it be physical disease, whether it be something with mental disease like depression, anxiety, things like that. No matter what it is, having a strong community is helpful. And so I think it's important to bear that in mind as well, that you don't just isolate and pull away into yourself, but you find people that you trust to build community with and have, conversations and have outings and try to stay connected in that way, so you're not just lost in your own thoughts about whatever it is that you're fighting.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So another part of the lifestyle space would be movement. So that's another big part of it. How does physical activity actually help reverse insulin resistance on a cellular level?
Excellent. So again, insulin resistance is the fact that your insulin that your body is making that's meant to control your sugars is no longer being as effective as it once was. Things, again, that will drive insulin resistance. We talked about medications, sedentary lifestyle, fat cells themselves drive insulin resistance. Physical activity, specifically cardiovascular or cardio, right? So elliptical, walking, swimming, jogging, biking. And World Health Organization says it could be as simple as walking, moderate intensity activity, 30 minutes 5 days out the week or an hour 3 days out the week can make a huge difference in that what it is allowing is for your insulin, as it hits the receptors on the muscle cells, it allows your muscles to actually absorb more insulin from the bloodstream, shift it into cells so that it can be used. Because sugar is what fuels your body, allows your body to move. It's not the only thing that fuels your body, and that's how keto diet works, and that's allowing fat to be used. But it's much, our body is most efficiently created to use sugar, aka glucose, for physical activity. So cardio is the name of the game.
Yep. And for our listeners, because people will say moderate, what does that mean? Because I know it's this thing that you, I think you could talk, but you can't sing, or you could.
Excellent question. So I usually use this example for patients is I will say, if you are going on a walk and carry a buddy with you, we were just talking about community, right? Let's say you and your husband are going to do it, whoever it might be. If you guys can have a full-blown conversation, you're not working hard enough. That's great for your mental health, great for your relationship. That's not going to do enough for your sugar or your blood pressure.
Fair.
So it needs to be something where you feel the burn. It doesn't have to be a stitch in your side or a Charlie horse or anything like that, but it has to be to the point where you feel a bit of a sweat. You can't, you know, have a full-blown conversation. You need to be in the moment working. Yeah. Now, I would also say moderate intensity is different for different people.
That is true.
So I usually tell patients when we talk about this, am I expecting you to do an hour of exercise the first day you go to exercise? Please don't do that to yourself. I usually suggest, especially for people who are not doing any sort of exercise, let's say they have a desk job and they don't move pretty much at work and they haven't been exercising. I say aim for 15 minutes, 3 days out the week. Work your way up to 30, 3 days out the week.
Right.
Then add the fourth and fifth day.
Yeah, baby steps.
Yeah, exactly. Because one, you have to build your stamina back up, right? Mm-hmm. Two, you're going to hate it, hate me, and never do it again. And that's not the goal. This is something to be long-term.
Yeah. You know, and I appreciate too, for people who, just as a recommendation, you know, those walking pads that you can have like at your desk at work, if you're in an office environment where that's a possibility,
sure.
You know,
Keep
things like that in mind,
yeah.
Because it's a way to kind of get it in with a little bit more intentionality in the workspace. And I see that's something that's become very popular. You go on Amazon, you see all kind of different options and things like that. one of the ladies in our group actually has a walking pad at her desk. So we did a steps challenge last week.
Okay.
And that's how she was able to help get her steps in, because she works late hours.
And
so she has it at her desk. She's able to do her steps while she's working. So things like that are very helpful. And it's like, it's being creative about, you know,
correct,
tackling the issue.
Correct.
Because, you know, you get in a rainy season, you're like, but Dr. Right. Cartwright, I can't go outside and get my cardio in.
If you could believe how many patients have actually said that to me in the last 2 weeks.
Well, because it's been
very
rainy.
No, of course it has been. But then I use it as an opportunity to say, you know, there are other things that you can do.
Yeah.
You could find free YouTube exercise videos.
Always a recommendation.
Right. You could do, for patients who have a lot of knee issues, I recommend swimming. But you'd be surprised how many of our people don't know how to swim. I'm like, come now, come. But either way, that's a different story for political in terms of finding us better access to safe places to swim. People are afraid of the water, right? In terms of what could be in the ocean. I divert. Come back to where your point is, Carmen. Is that you can find other ways to exercise. And you have to find also something that you enjoy. So for instance, when I'm a good girl, I'll do a workout video in my front room. 5 o'clock in the morning, because I have two small children. I have no other time in my day to do it. You know, my husband refuses to do it. He's like, that's boring. I don't want to do that. He wants to ride his bicycle. And that's important for you to also find something that you enjoy to do.
Yes.
Because if you can also find it to be enjoyable, that helps it to make more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay. So for someone who is busy, maybe already overweight, or maybe hasn't exercised in years, what's the single smartest move that they can do to start for blood sugar control? Is it walking after meals? Is it like strength training? Is it short bursts of the day? What would you say if you could do just one thing today to start, what would it be?
And one thing to start specifically physical activity?
Yes,
wise.
Physical
okay,
activity.
Okay, understood. Walking. Just start with walking, because you want more of that cardio.
Yeah.
I will say that the more muscle you can have, that will change your insulin resistance as well. So if you can then introduce the weights as well, that would be awesome. But walking. Start somewhere. Start with something. Get your body moving. Sometimes people, again, will get overwhelmed and they'll be like, oh, I got to go get a subscription to MacFit. If that's what you want to do, go for it. But it doesn't have to be that.
And as I say, we have a lot of spaces now where you can just walk, right? Like, we have beaches on every, we walk along the beach. You walk along Montague, you walk along, you know, Saunders, you can walk along Goodman's Bay. Like, even now, as the weather starts to get a little bit cooler, like, the Bahama Strip is really awesome right now because you have a lot of cover with the trees. So you get shade, you don't have to get beaten down by the sun.
Right.
But it's like, there's opportunities, and it's free 99, like people like to say, right?
Understood, yes.
Because, you know, people have that part of the struggle as well. It's like, well, how do I pay for a subscription at the gym? And then, again, it goes back to finding something that you enjoy and making that work for you.
And I think if, you know, certain times when we look at the world that we live in, mm-hmm. From a safety standpoint,
yes.
Then that's another reason to get a buddy. Yes. Let somebody walk with you. Because mm-hmm. I know sometimes that'll also be a hindrance that people will get nervous to say, I don't want to go walking X time, especially now the time is going to shift and it's going to get darker earlier, right? Mm-hmm. But we also have to find a way to not make excuses and yes. make it work.
Fair.
So, you know, you just have to find the safest way that works for you.
Fair point. I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors and we'll be right back.
Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 242-8164-OPP, 4667, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus, where your health comes first.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring, compassionate, complete.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI at Top of the Hill, Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 242-32-21145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring. Compassionate. Complete.
Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation. So let's move into what I think sometimes is a very interesting conversation for people because they don't often think about it. So sleep, stress, and hormones. So how do stress hormones, poor sleep, make blood sugar worse, even if you are, you know, working on your diet or working on your physical activity? What role do those two factors play in stress hormones and poor sleep?
Okay. So unfortunately, I think it's a vicious cycle in that poor sleep can increase your stress hormones. And then stress hormones would be things such as cortisol. Although, let me plug this right here, right now, not everyone has cortisol excess that is dealing with stress. Cortisol is a hormone that allows us to overcome infection, and it is our stress hormone in that way. Helps us to maintain good blood pressure. If your blood pressure starts to drop, it helps to bring it up. If your sugar starts to drop, it brings it up. The reason I plug it that way, unfortunately, there's a lot of information out in TikTok and social media talking about, you know, so many aspects of cortisol that would be a talk in and of itself that drives me just a little crazy as an endocrinologist. Shout out to my colleagues out there who are also feeling the pain. But cortisol, if it is heightened because of stress, and it doesn't mean that it's a sustained elevation, will affect your insulin resistance. And I think inadequate sleep, unfortunately, drives that as well, because especially people who work shift work, people who chronically work night shifts, they unfortunately have higher risk for that just because of the lifestyle. And a lot of times, unfortunately, because of the world we live in, people have to pay bills, and that's the job that they have. Right. It can affect them, and they can't really, you know, control that aspect. but I would say inadequate sleep can lead to excess stress hormones. I would say, because when we talked about insulin resistance, there are some specifically endocrine disorders that can also affect it. So again, Cushing's, which would be excess cortisol when your body's inappropriately making too much, which can be your body, or it can be constant exposure to prednisone. Like, let's say, again, you're having joint problems, lung problems, you're constantly being given prednisone, dexamethasone, Medrol dose packs. That's going to drive insulin resistance. So that's something that we, unfortunately, as physicians can induce. Sometimes it's rightfully done because you can't live otherwise, whether right. it be pain or lung issues. But that's something to keep aware. Growth hormone excess is another thing. So I tell patients, if you know we're constantly seeing you're gaining weight, you're changing your shoe size, rings that you used to be able to fit don't fit anymore, growth hormone might be in excess. So we have to be on the lookout for things of that nature as well.
Okay. You know, we like to give people takeaways that they can move with. So what would be one realistic sleep or stress change that has the biggest payoff for sugar control in the shortest time frame?
Adequate sleep. So I would say aiming for 7 to 8 hours mm-hmm. of sleep okay. and ensuring that it's adequate sleep mm-hmm. in that, you know, there are a lot of people with unrecognized sleep apnea in our community too.
Not all sleep is equal.
Exactly. So I would say 7 to 8 hours is your goal for achievement.
Okay.
Yep.
Fair enough. So let's move into talking about tools, medications, clinical support, you know, monitoring. Obviously, that's a big part of this conversation about pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. How useful is checking your own sugar at home for someone with pre-diabetes?
For pre-diabetes, not as useful, to be truthful with you, in that there isn't a lot of data to say that it's going to drastically affect outcomes for that patient if they're checking their sugar every single day. However, I would say, even though I don't have as much clinical data to prove it, I will still occasionally recommend it to patients, in that on an infrequent basis, do a fasting blood sugar check so you can see where you're at, especially if I have someone who's on the higher end of pre-diabetes and almost in the spectrum of flipping over into type 2. That would be a patient where I would really suggest it. Again, you could consider things like the continuous glucose monitor. I mentioned the Dexcom Stelo. I don't really recommend it for people who are not pre-diabetic. I don't recommend it for non-diabetics, because then we have to really understand what are we looking at data-wise and what does it mean for you. And that's going to create unnecessary anxiety when you don't need it. But I would say for pre-diabetics, if we're not necessarily doing frequent finger sticks, which is more so important for type 2s, then I would say at least checking in with your physician on a like biannual basis, 6 months. If, again, their A1C is at the upper end of the spectrum, almost into type 2, then sometimes I do it at 3 months, mm-hmm. exactly, so that I could catch it in case they flip into actual right. type 2 diabetes.
Makes sense, because you want to catch it as quickly as possible. All right. So for some of the type 2 diabetes, you know, from a physician's perspective, because you know data is very important in how you're helping to manage patients, do you prefer finger sticks or continuous glucose monitors or both?
I prefer, if all things were created equal, continuous glucose monitors, in that it helps to relieve the burden of patients in terms of not having to do finger sticks, right? However, I like to remind patients that continuous glucose monitors are not the end-all be-all. They still have errors 20% of the time, as much as 30% of the time, it will overestimate a low. It will ding and alarm you that you're low, you're feeling fine, you do a finger stick and you're not actually low. Certain things like vitamin C, especially in high doses for Freestyle Libre, which I know a lot more of that is ubiquitous in the community. Dexcom is the other big one that's available here. But for Freestyle, high doses of vitamin C can give you false high levels. So it can make your diabetes actually look worse than it really is. So again, they're not the end all be all. But I like that in that it relieves some of the burden. But if finger sticks is what you have to do because of cost or also comfort, some people don't want to wear devices. Mm-hmm. And that's a very personal decision to make.
Yes.
I just need data.
Yeah,
I just need numbers.
Yeah, because yeah. it helps you to manage the patient.
Correct.
You know, the last time I think we had you on talking about diabetes in particular, obviously, you know, it's all of the drugs that people know nowadays, your Mounjaro and
Ozempic
and, yeah. Ozempic and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, I guess the question, I think the big question here for me is, can medications be used as a bridge to remission, or, you know, are you, once you're on the medications, is it like you're on it forever?
And that's a constant concern and dilemma that I will face with patients, because that is a very valid concern people will have. If, let's say, you know, I meet a patient that is morbidly obese and they have a very poor diet, then I will generally say this is likely going to be a bridge. If I have someone, especially people of Asian descent, who are more often to be of a leaner profile in terms of their body type, but they can be more, even at that smaller size, be higher risk for insulin resistance, because we see that in that genetic pool, it may be harder for me to say, am I going to be able to remove it? But I always tell patients, time, your finger sticks, your blood work is what's going to help us to see, could we get there? You know, some of the pre-diabetic patients, I may offer them metformin, which is, you know, the oldest school, apart from insulin, beg your pardon, diabetic medication out there that we still consider as first-line medication. I might recommend it to them, especially if, let's say, they have been at a 6.3 at the upper end of pre-diabetes, right? Almost tipping into diabetes for years, and we don't see it budging despite maximal lifestyle effort. I might recommend that to them. Unfortunately, currently in our market, GLP-1 agonist, GLP-1 GIP agonist, that would be Ozempic or Mounjaro, Saxenda, which is an older one that's available in country. The insurances are not covering it for pre-diabetes. Even if, let's say, that person is morbidly obese and also has high blood pressure, or also has obstructive sleep apnea, or also has fatty liver disease, I continue to write pre-certification letters because I'm trying to change the landscape, as I'm sure my colleagues are doing the same, to say, hopefully at some point they will. In the US, because I have colleagues that I still keep in contact with, some plans will cover it for a pre-diabetic, but at this moment in time, it's not covered. Would I consider it if somebody wanted to do it? Again, they've maximized lifestyle. They've sat down with Mrs. Cambridge. They're doing the exercise. They're showing me what they can do, and they're still having a hard time, and they want to do it to help give them that extra push. I have that conversation with them, but unfortunately, it's often not going to be covered by insurance.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, some people, they hear insulin and they think this is the end of the road. Is going on insulin always permanent, or can people come off of it if they are able to make sustainable change?
I have had many patients come off of insulin. I do have a lot of people have that fear. And sometimes that fear is quite legitimate. Again, if they are a long-term uncontrolled diabetic and they have essentially burnt their pancreas, or let's say someone who's had recurrent pancreatitis because they're an alcoholic, unfortunately, and their pancreas gets destroyed, there can become a time that person can only have insulin. There's no other way to manage their diabetes. But I always have that opening with the patient to say, my hope is that it will not be lifelong. Only time will tell me. Now, type 1s, unfortunately, we know that, right? But for type 2s, my hope is always to try and minimize. I've had a patient, I can think of her in my mind, that I met her, I've known her a little over a year and a half now. When I first met her, she was in the hospital because of her diabetes. We started on 4 times per day insulin regimen, 2 different types of insulin. And with lifestyle changes and also transition to Ozempic, she's off all insulin now. So it can definitely happen. Again, it just has to be, you know, maximizing lifestyle and also just your genetics and your overall health picture. Because I don't want the patients out there, anyone's listening who hears me say that, and they're like, well, look, I'm doing everything I can with my lifestyle and this still isn't budging. Sometimes it's also the genetic hand you're dealt that we may not be able to change that. But my goal is always to try and minimize the insulin for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the start of our conversation where you're talking about things that you can and can't change in terms of your risk factors, right?
Yeah.
So we are running out of time. I want to ask you one more big thing before we wrap up. What are the most dangerous myths that you'd love to retire forever about diabetes and pre-diabetes in our community? We have to hit that before we go.
Oh my gosh. That metformin will put you into kidney failure. That you could never eat birthday cake again. and that it can be done with bush medicines. In that, let me, you know, expound on each one of those individually. Metformin, again, has been a medication around since the 1950s. It is an excellent medication. It doesn't mean it's not without risk. Every medication has a risk, unfortunately. Even vitamins in excess can hurt you. I know everybody, you know, on the supplement hype, it can still hurt you if it's too much, some of them. Metformin does not cause kidney failure if you are appropriately being managed and watched with your physician. Metformin, glucophage is another name. If your kidneys are not working well, there will become a time where I can't give you that medication anymore and it has to be removed. But itself does not cause kidney failure. So unfortunately, I have these patients who will have seen a family member go through it. And then I have to try and reframe their mind to help them understand that it's not the metformin that led to the kidney failure. It's uncontrolled diabetes. It's likely that they needed more than metformin, but said, "Doc, I don't want to go on insulin." That might have led to it, right? And then the second one I said was about birthday cake. And that's just a joke. I don't expect you to eat birthday cake every day, right? But that goes back to when we spoke about lifestyle, in that you have to find something sustainable and realistic. And then bush medicines. I am not open to the concept of bush medicines being helpful. But unfortunately, a lot of patients who end up reverting to that side of natural options, a lot of them will not continue to monitor what is happening with their body. And then they end up in a really bad situation. The other problem I have with natural options is, until we have a study that shows you how it works, how it interacts with other things, I don't know how your soursop leaf tea is going to interfere with the medications I give you. So I always tell people that's my worry. I'm not opposed to it. Some of the medicines we use were, you know, found in the bark of trees, in the spit of lizards. Yeah. I'm open to it, but you need data to be safe to
All right, as we wrap up then, for someone, so it's basically two parts. For someone who either is, you know, told that they're borderline, or for someone who is already a type 2 diabetic, what would you say are the first two changes you want them to make this week to start to work towards trying to get in remission?
Excellent. I would say if you are drinking sodas or sugar-sweetened beverages, let them go. Eat your carbs rather than drink them. I think when people drink their carbs, they really don't appreciate how much they are having. Exactly. Portion control also goes along with that, because again, portion size is not real for us. And then exercise. Start with at least walking and work your way up to some exercise. It will make a huge difference for your life overall.
Awesome. And I guess one final thing, when should someone, what is a sign or a couple of signs that should tell a patient that they need to go beyond primary care and come and see an endocrinologist like you?
Oh, please come down and see me. I would say hemoglobin A1C levels greater than 9% off the bat should be coming to see me or one of my colleagues. If you are constantly hitting a wall where your doctor is increasing and increasing and increasing your medications and you really don't see a change, come and have a conversation. And then if you are worried that there might be something else going on in your lifestyle and your health, and that it's not just simple diabetes, if you wonder if it's excess cortisol, is it excess growth hormone, is there something else driving it? Come and see us, come and have help so we can try and help you understand what's going on.
Okay, awesome. All right, thank you so much, Dr. Cartwright, for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us again on Vital Voices. A lot of great information for our listeners. Thank you for your time and your expertise as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so for our listeners, here's what you need to remember from this conversation today with Dr. Carmen Cartwright. Pre-diabetes is a warning light, not a life sentence, and catching it early gives you power. And even with type 2 diabetes, many people can reduce meds, protect organs, and in some cases, reach remission. It is not too late. If this episode has helped you, please share it with someone who needs to hear that they are not stuck. You can find more episodes of Vital Voices on YouTube and everywhere you get your podcasts. Follow, subscribe, and tell us what you want to talk about, what you want us to talk about next. Until next time, stay informed, stay connected, stay well, and stay tuned for the next Vital Voice.
We'd like to thank today's sponsors, Oak Tree Medical Center and Wellspring Lifestyle Group.
Did you miss a part of today's show? You can catch this episode and all Vital Voices episodes online at youtube.com/@VitalVoices242. See you next week as we sit down with another Vital Voice.
Vital Voices.